Disclaimer, this episode contains topics that some viewers may find disturbing. Listener discretion is advised. We do not support underage drinking, excessive drinking, binge drinking, or any other unsafe drinking behavior. Please drink responsibly, never drink and drive.
So today, we'll be talking about the sudden disappearance of a family of four. For years, both the public and authorities believed that they had fled to another country, until the discovery of human remains in the Mojave Desert forced them to reevaluate everything. This is the story of the Mixtape.
Welcome to the Conundrum Bar. I'm your bartender, Raquel, and your host,
Natalia.
Mianza.
Join us every Friday for a new conundrum, from murder to mystery to alien sightings and paranormal occurrences.
Bella's drink of the week. It will be a margarita. And I don't like margarita mixers or anything like that, so it will be a whole lime. And also, all of our ice got stolen right before we started, so we don't have ice today, but everything else is chilled. So next, you can put a quarter of an orange, half an orange, however orange you like it. And you can even leave the orange peel in there because it gives it a nice orangey tone in the drink itself. So then next, put your tequila, 1 to 2 shots, or however strong you like it.
Wait, damn, my
Then I always like to put an orange liqueur. My favorite is the orange Curacao, but I didn't have it, so I went with this that I could find.
So choose which one you like. Also, 1 shot, and 1.5 ounces. You can top it with
pineapple juice, and then Leanne's getting orange juice because she doesn't like pineapple.
We'll make it, make it tailored to how you like it.
That's why she's our personal bartender.
And Leanne's orange juice. There you have it. Conundrum Bar Margarita.
On the morning of Thursday, February 4th, 2010, less than 3 months after moving into their new house, Joseph McStay talked on the phone with his father, Patrick McStay. He mentioned that he had a meeting with a business partner, Chase Merritt, around noon, so he had to hurry and hang up so that he could head out. Chase and Joseph were business partners in Joseph's custom water fountain company called EIP, Earth Inspired Products. So they literally designed and built custom fountains for like indoor companies, all of that. Joseph had hired Chase a few years back as designer and welder of the fountain. So not only welding, but he worked with like the rocks, like concrete, anything that they were using for the fountains. His wife, Joseph's wife, Summer, on the other hand, had stayed home that morning taking care of their 2 sons, 4-year-old Gianni and 3-year-old Joseph Jr. And she was also overseeing the renovation of their home, which they had just recently moved into, less than 3 months. They were working to make it into their dream home. So according to friends and family, they had been buying things on Craigslist, such as like countertops, appliances, just stuff for the renovation. Summer had also spoke on the phone with her sister that morning. Her sister had just recently had a baby, so Summer was promising that she was going to go visit her soon so she could meet her nephew or niece. I'm not too sure what she had. The day before, on February 3rd, a family friend had come over to help paint the house and was planning to return on Saturday the 6th. Summer and Joseph had also planned on having a birthday party for about-to-be 3-year-old Joseph Jr. on February 6th, that Saturday. So on Thursday, February 4th, at 4:25, the home phone calls Joseph's cell phone, so we assume Summer, right? At 5:47 p.m., there are texts exchanged between Joseph and Summer's cell phones. And at 7:47 p.m., Thursday night, the neighbor surveillance camera catches the family's Isuzu Trooper leaving the driveway. However, it only catches the bottom portion of the car, so they can't see who's in it. At 8:28 p.m., Joseph calls Chase Merritt, his business partner, and Chase says that he missed the call. He never talked to Joseph. That was the last contact that anyone would ever have with the family. On February 9th, just 5 days after the McStays went missing, Dan Kavanaugh, who was the business's website manager, reached out to Patrick out of concern. Patrick was already concerned because he talked with Joseph all the time. They talked almost every day. So he was already starting to get worried. According to crimemuseum.org, after the family and friends hadn't heard from the McStay family, they sent a co-worker to the house on February 9th. He found the dogs, Bear and Digger, outside with food, so he just assumed that someone was feeding them while the family went away for maybe like a quick vacation or something, or just like a weekend away. And then, according to the San Diego Union Tribune, however, on February 10th, the following day, a sheriff's deputy does a welfare check, but since no one is home and no one answers, he has to leave because there's nothing he can do. And there's no sign of foul play. Again, according to Crime Museum, on February 13th, Joseph's brother, Michael, goes to check on the family, and this time he managed to get into the house through a partially open window. So he got into the house. He leaves a note for whoever was feeding the dogs to call him. Hey, just want to check up, you know, can you give me a call? I'm the brother. That night, that same night, he receives a call from animal control that they were going to take the dogs because they had been left without care for over a week. According to that same article from Crime Museum, it turns out the animal control officer is the one that had fed the dogs. But take this with a grain of salt, because this is the only reference to an animal control officer that I could find. So I'm not sure if that actually happened, or so just take that one with a grain of salt. According to Patrick, Joseph's father, Bear, with the dog, he was a big dog, and then Digger was like a little dog. I'll show you guys pictures later. Bear was like another child to Summer. He says that she loved him, and there's no way that she would ever leave him like that without care. Which we totally understand. Yeah.
Very much so.
So on February 15th, which is now 11 days since the family has gone missing, Michael reports the family missing, and the police come to do a quick sweep of the house. The police search the house, but there was no indication of foul play. Even they did find like popcorn bowls on the couch that were like spilled. They found raw eggs on the counter and like coffee grounds on the counter. So it was a bit of a mess. They noted that Summer's prescription sunglasses were also left behind. They found a lamp knocked over in the bedroom, open suitcases with clothes thrown around in the closet. And so this was like the only thing that they found, so there was no indication of foul play to them. They did not tape up the house as a crime scene, and were just treating it as a missing persons case, right? Well, a few days earlier, on February 8th, at around 11 o'clock p.m., the family's Isuzu Trooper had been impounded at the U.S.-Mexico border town of San Ysidro, California. As soon as the police found out about the impounded car, they seized it for evidence. Again, there was no signs of foul play in the car. There was the kids' booster seats in the back. There was the seat positions were about the right positioning for it to be Summer and Joseph in the car. There was the kids' toys, you know, no indication. During this time, this whole time, because the house had not been taped up and it was not being treated as a homicide, Joseph's mother called the sheriff's office and got permission to enter the house. So she entered the house and proceeded to clean it. So she wiped all the counters, she cleaned the whole house.
I'm sorry, but my mom would be way more concerned about trying to find me than cleaning my house.
That's kind of my thought, too.
Unless, like, you know, like, maybe they were worried or whatever, you know, when you just have to do something because you can't do nothing else. So you're probably cleaning the house because you can't find nothing else, like, to do but worry.
That's
like,
very possible. And that friend that had come over on the 3rd to help paint the house, he was with her. So he also found it very suspicious. Like, his, in one of the interviews, it says that his first thought was that she's destroying evidence. But again, it was not a taped-off crime scene, so she technically wasn't doing anything wrong. Michael, Joseph's brother, was also given permission from the sheriff's office to take Joseph's computer and his SD card, which he says he only downloaded all the pictures off of it for safekeeping and then returned the computer to the house. Okay.
Where was this SD card? Was it a camera or...
I'm not sure. It didn't specify. It just said his computer and SD card.
Were they ever able to, like, look on the computer, make sure he didn't delete nothing, or...
We'll kind of get into it. Okay. A little bit. Back to the car. The car was impounded from a parking lot in front of a shopping mall across from a bank in San Ysidro, California. So the police tried to check video footage, but the only video was from the car parking lot itself, like the security footage. According to surveillance from the parking lot, the car didn't arrive until February 4th, four days since the family went missing. So 4 days that were unaccounted for. No one knows what happened in those 4 days. Upon investigation, they discovered that neither of the family's cars had crossed the border into Mexico, or at least there was no registry of it. And just a side note, after discussion with family and friends, they stated that Summer would have never gone to Mexico. That she had made it very clear that she felt that it was too unsafe to visit and that she was not comfortable
not going Daniel. To Mexico. That's me and I'm Mexican.
So anyways, just thought. Less than 2 hours after parking the car, surveillance video showed at 7 p.m., February 8th, a family of four crossing the border. The family looks similar to the McStays, and police asked their family to help identify them from the video, see if they recognize them. So they recognized the woman and children that they could possibly be Summer and the boys, they said, but Joseph's mother and a few other people did not believe that it was Joseph. She said that, like, from the interviews, she said that she knows her son and that wasn't the way he walked and stuff. But the family was dressed very similarly to how the McStays normally dress. And the investigators did believe that it was him and the family after comparison to several home videos that they retrieved about them.
So... I'm just gonna put this out there, a whole thing of what I'm thinking now. Did the brother pretend to be the other brother? Take us for the family and say something happened to him? Maybe that's why the house was in chaos. They were trying to pack to leave quick. This is just a theory, so.
There's a few theories around this one. So, Leanza, that's your theory. I hadn't seen that one yet, but we'll go with it. Okay, guys. So, I want to show you the video of this border surveillance and let me know if you can even make out any details about this family. Okay?
Wow, I like you can't even see their faces. They're just like bodies moving.
And they have jackets and hats on. I don't understand how anybody can see anything.
Yeah.
Or tell anything.
In the video, they're moving away from the camera, so all you can see is their backs. And like they're just using, like I said, home videos to kind of compare how they move and stuff, but they did say they're dressed very similarly to how the McStays usually dress, because in one article it did say that the boys had long, like, curly hair, so a lot of times they would have, like, a beanie on just to kind of control it a little bit, but...
I don't know, because anyone could buy the same type of clothes, like, you know?
And it was February, so, I mean, it's possibly a little bit colder.
It was also dark, like... It would look like more of a nighttime shot, so...
Yeah, I mean, this was taken, like, at 7 p.m., So it was pretty late already.
I was honestly expecting, like, them crossing the desert when you said they were crossing the border. Honestly, I'm like, they got them and they let them go?
Yeah. Sorry. No, but we'll have this video linked if you guys want to watch it. Let us know your opinions if you can make out anyone in this video. Back to the story. The investigators couldn't find any evidence of the family's passports being used. As a matter of fact, Summer's passport was expired, and there was no application on record for renewal. The boys didn't have passports, and their birth certificates were left at home. So even if they did cross the border into Mexico, there was no way they're going to be able to come back. So when police looked into the computer, there were some internet searches showing someone had searched how to get passports to Mexico and some other Mexico-related searches. And so by this time, police were pretty convinced that the family had fled to Mexico. There was supposedly some sightings of the family in Mexico from people that had served them and stuff, but all of those leads came up empty. I'm gonna take a drink here. After this, the case went cold. No new leads until Tuesday, April 9th, 2013. So 3 years later, the police made a statement, quote, "Due to the fact that the family is believed to be out of the country and because minor children are involved, the primary investigative responsibility for the case is being transferred to the FBI," unquote. So they now switched all investigative authority to the FBI because they could search in other countries that they were believed to be in. Susan, Joseph's mother, told CNN that, quote, "I'm very happy for this. I'm happy to get more from the international part of that. Now it can reach across to all other countries. It doesn't mean that they're necessarily in Mexico, but it will keep their names and faces out there. It's just a big benefit," unquote. Which she's right. It's going to keep the investigation going, because up to right now, local authorities have nothing.
And they can't really do much anyways.
Right. So, Patrick, Joseph's father, on the other hand, on a CNN special report, said that he spent every waking moment looking for information about his son and family. Like, he would literally wake up, go to his computer, check for emails, check his Facebook, check if anyone had seen anything new. And that was his life for 3 years since they had gone missing.
What about the brother? What was he doing in all this time?
I mean, the whole family was active in the search, but Patrick was the one that was the most active. And when they went missing, Patrick was actually in Texas. So in the CNN special report, like, he hired a private investigator to get, like, second opinions of everything. And he was, like, super, super involved with the case. As a matter of fact, an investigative journalist named Steve Watts, that they also interviewed in the CNN special report, referred to Patrick as, quote, "one of the best investigators on the case," unquote.
I feel like that's good. Like, I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying that if my mom were to search for me, she'd do all that. But my dad does not know how to do any of that or look any of that up online. So it'd be my mom doing active.
Yeah, that's accurate. I feel like, I don't know, my dad knows how to use the internet, but I feel like he wouldn't really know where to look either. So, moving forward to November 11th, 2013, at 9:58 a.m., a, quote, "off-roading motorcyclist," unquote, which I'm pretty sure is just a dirt biker, made a 911 call to report finding human remains in the Mojave Desert, outside of Vectorville, which is about 100 miles north of the McStays' home and 250 miles from the border.
Nowhere in the direction they were supposedly last seen.
Nowhere. Actually, the complete opposite. Yeah. The remains were found way out in the desert of Vectorville. Upon investigation, detectives uncovered two shallow graves, each containing a human adult and a human child. Along with the bodies, police found clothing in the graves, tire tracks nearby, and they also found a sledgehammer in one of the graves. Patrick told CNN in their special report that he had a gut feeling since the day they went missing that he would never see his family again. And 4 days after finding the grave, Patrick's worst nightmare came true. Using dental records, they were confirmed to be the McStay family.
My goodness.
Yeah. That was like, when you watch the CNN special report, just like, he starts breaking down at some points, and it's like so emotional. Like, I was getting teared up at some points. It's, yeah. So, it was determined that the cause of death for all four of the family members was blunt force trauma. And it said that it was likely that they did not die immediately, which means that there probably was some suffering for them.
That sucks.
Which just makes it worse when you think about a 4-year-old and a 3-year-old having to die that way. Like, yeah. So, going into some theories now, now that they have bodies, they have to reopen the case, reinvestigate it as a homicide now. One theory going around was that the McStay family had been killed by a Mexican cartel after a business deal gone bad.
I have a question. Did the business, like, have anything to do with that? Like, where did he work?
Some of the theories. We're actually gonna go pretty hard into that. So the reason that some people thought this Mexican cartel theory was because apparently before they moved into their new house, the family had lived in a small 2-bedroom apartment in San Clemente, California. And according to the man that lived on the same street as them and had actually moved into their old apartment after they moved out, their rent was about $850 a month. And according to him, the McStays were behind on their rent and about to be evicted. He also said that he kept getting mail that they didn't redirect to their new home. He got letters, so they were letters from an attorney working for a surgical office who had paid Joseph $14,000 for a fountain and hadn't received anything. He received letters from the IRS and debt collection, but however, it was unclear in any of these articles if those letters started coming around before the family went missing or after. So it's possible that like the IRS and debt collections could have started happening after the family went missing for 3 years and hadn't made payments on anything.
Okay. I'm confused. So he opened all the mail?
Yeah.
Because when I get mail, I don't know, I just throw it away. Like, I'm not gonna read it.
Yeah. That was one of my thoughts, too. I was like, okay, you're just going through other people's mail. Sure.
Yeah, isn't that illegal?
I'm pretty sure it's illegal, yeah.
Not okay. Saying nothing bad. It's just like, I never go through people's mail.
Yeah. I know, I give you your mail, and I'm pretty sure it goes straight in the trash.
Yeah, it does.
I usually put not this address and put it back in the mailbox.
Oh, dang, she's a good one.
Anyways. So, the theory is that it's a little suspicious, or at least hard to understand, how they went from verge of eviction to buying a $300,000 house and having $100,000 in the bank. Although it's worth noting that they were both licensed real estate agents and had purchased the home out of foreclosure. So it's possible that they got like a super good deal on it, but that still doesn't explain the $100,000 in their account when they were on the verge of eviction.
Did they, by chance, because they were real estate agents, did they check their accounts to see like if maybe they sold something to?
I could not find any information about that. So law enforcement does not believe that it was a professional hit as far as the cartel goes, because of how close the bodies were found to the road and the shallow graves. And not only that, but why would the Mexican cartel take the time to stage the car all the way by the border and like bury the family 250 miles away? Like, I don't think they'd waste their time doing that.
I have the same thoughts too, because how many bodies out there that haven't been found? Like, why would they put them somewhere like in away from Mexico?
Yeah.
They're the Mexican cartel.
Unless they just wanted to really throw them off, and they did it and then took their car home back to Mexico. I mean,
possibly. Maybe. I mean, hey, that's one theory that's running around, so just figured I'd throw it in there. So by this time, you know, the family had been adamant to the police that they were not in Mexico. They had never been in Mexico.
I have one more question. With the computer, were they looking into going to Mexico weeks before they disappeared, or was it the day that the brother took the computer and he checked into Mexico?
So it does say it was before they disappeared.
Okay.
So it was before they disappeared.
Well, my theory is going down the drain, probably.
So they're looking into the case, you know, they got positive IDs, they got remains now. One of the people that police looked at was Dan Cavanaugh, the business website manager, because 2 days after the family went missing, on February 6th, he withdrew money from the business account, and later in the summer, he sold Joseph's company. He seized the company and sold it. However, he was later ruled out as a suspect based on evidence putting him in Hawaii during that time. But put a pin in that, because we're coming back to him.
Okay, because I was going to ask, was it part of their business deal that they had? Like, if one of them just so happened to disappear, that one would get full control? Or did he do it after their remains were found?
So, I couldn't find anything. That was a question that kept coming up as far as, like, was it in the contract for you to get the business if something happens? But I couldn't find anything about it.
Okay.
But we're going to be coming back to him, like, hard. So.
Okay.
So just keep him in mind. The next person that they looked into and apparently had been keeping an eye on for a while was Chase Merritt, the business partner, the actual business partner. Well, it wasn't really a business partner, but we'll go into it. Although Chase and Joseph met through the business, they eventually became, as Chase himself put it, best friends. However, Chase had a history of gambling issues. He eventually racked up over $42,000 in debt to Joseph.
I wish I had $42,000 to give you two.
I wish you did too. You know? That'd be great.
That's insane.
So Joseph actually kept a spreadsheet with a running total of how much Chase owed him. And later, a friend of Chase described him as cold when they were speaking about the McStay family. And he said he was just getting, like, some very bad vibes from him.
He was being ghosty.
He was being ghosty.
I hope you don't keep no tabs on whatever we owe you.
I already owe you a lot, and I haven't known you that long.
Oh my god.
So apparently, since the bodies had been found, the police were keeping tabs on Chase every single day. They knew what he was doing, where he was going, who he was seeing every day. He was, you know, their
person of interest.
Person of interest. Over the course of the investigation, quite a few things came to light. The year before the McStay family went missing, Joseph had been receiving increasing complaints about Chase's work. He had even been advised by some other associates that maybe he should be looking for someone else because his work had gone down in quality. And, like, they had told him that in the CNN special report, they did mention that they had advised him, hey, maybe you should give some work to some other welder, just kind of put pressure on him, see if he'll step up his game again. The last call that we mentioned was on February 4th at 8:28 from Joseph to Chase, right? Chase told CNN that he did not answer the call. He had not talked to Joseph. But he later told Patrick that he did answer the call and that it was just a quick sum up of their lunch meeting. Chase also told CNN that their lunch meeting had went well and Joseph had seemed happy. But again, he told Patrick that they had a fight, but they worked it out. That the fight had been about a damaged fountain that would need to be fixed, or Chase would have to give back the money that Joseph had already given him from the fountain. But Chase had already spent it. Also, Patrick, who had been a big part of the investigation, believed that the person that killed the Mestay family was someone that knew the area well, because it wasn't somewhere that you just stumbled upon, right? Mm-hmm. Desert. It was later discovered that the bodies were found 7 minutes from Chase's sister's home and 18 minutes from his old high school, which means he was probably familiar with the area. Apparently, Patrick had also been keeping touch with Chase regularly since the disappearance of the family, and as he put it in the CNN special report, quote, "to keep your enemies close," unquote. Exactly. The more he researched, the more he suspected Chase, although he didn't want to believe it, because he believed that if Joseph was friends with him, he was a good person. Joseph talked about him highly. Like, he didn't want to believe that he could possibly be the person that...
It's hard to believe the worst in someone like that.
Exactly. So, on Wednesday, November 5th, 2014, 4 years after the family went missing, Chase Merritt was arrested and charged with the murder of the McStay family. And up until now, we haven't covered much evidence that could connect him to the case, right? There's speculation, there's some sketchy stuff, but nothing hard evidence. Other than he was the last person to have talked to Joseph, but...
That he lied.
Yeah, but still, that's not hard evidence to convict someone, right?
Yeah.
Well, in 2015, search warrants and documents about the case were unsealed. Remember the family friend that we mentioned earlier that was planning to go back on Saturday to finish painting? And he had gone back with Susan and thought it was weird that she was cleaning up? Well, according to these records, the friend returned on February 17, 2010 with Susan, and he noticed three things that struck him as weird. One, the cover to the futon that he specifically remembers having it covered was gone. Two, there was dried paint in the paint tray, which was weird because he had just showed Summer how to line the tray with foil so that she wouldn't have to clean up. So lastly, he noticed the clothes all over the bedroom, which he had previously been roommates with Joseph and had said that Joseph was a very clean and organized person. So it would be very out of the ordinary for the bedroom to be thrown around like that. Because of these strange things, investigators now had reason to believe that the McStay family was killed inside their home and later moved to the burial site. Further cementing the story is the fact that the missing futon cover was used to wrap Joseph's body and was found at the graves.
Wow.
Also, Summer had a possible paint stain on her bra, which would coincide with the tray of paint found in the house. And because originally, the investigators did not have reason to believe that the McStay family had been murdered, they never processed the house as a crime scene and, quote, "did not process the residence for Latin evidence such as blood," unquote.
I have a question. Did they update, like, probably, I was just wondering maybe if they updated it to date, or they, if someone's missing, do they block the house off, like?
I don't know what about that one, but you would think you'd want to preserve any evidence just in case it does turn into a homicide or something.
That's what I would think would happen, even in just a plain missing persons, because that would be where you can find evidence if they just left, or if they...
Or if someone else was in the house, or anything. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think you'd want to preserve that just in case. These documents revealed that the investigators had swabbed the McStay car when they first found it back in 2011, but never tested it until February of 2014, after the bodies were found. If they had tested it back then, they would have discovered that there was male DNA not matching Joseph on the steering wheel, the shifter, the radio, and the AC controls. The DNA matched Chase Merritt. 3 years, 4 years after the bodies were found. They're barely testing it. How long ago could they have, like, closed this case? Just saying.
And that's the business partner.
That's the business partner, yes. According to interviews with San Diego Sheriff's Office in February 2010, Merritt had told them that the last time he had been in the McStay car was 6 weeks before the disappearance, and he was only a passenger. He did not drive. Also suspicious, during this interview, Merritt had a cut on his hand that he said he got while he was working with some sheet metal. Okay. So,
I had a question. The cut on his hand, where were they suspecting that blood was? Did he bring that up, or did they find also blood, or was it just...
They did not mention any blood findings, just DNA.
So he just forthcoming, I cut my hand in sheet metal a couple weeks.
Well, I'm assuming they questioned him on the cut on his hand during the interview. Okay. We're like, hey, you have a cut on your hand. Where did you get that? And he was like, oh, I was working on some sheet metal, probably on a fountain.
Okay, so this was like during the first...
This was in 2010 okay. when the first interviews happened.
Okay.
Police also obtained phone records, which showed, quote, Merritt was in a position to access the cellular tower northeast of the McStay family gravesite on February 6, 2010, 2 days after the family was last seen alive. Merritt made 6 phone calls in the area between 10:46 a.m. and 1:30 p.m. that day, unquote. So he was in the area and made several calls. He also had a history of nonviolent felonies, which included burglary, petty theft, trespassing, receiving stolen property, and grand theft. His most recent felony was in 2001 when he admitted to stealing $32,000 worth of welding and drilling equipment from a company in Monrovia, California. So, there's also speculation as to whether or not he was able to pull this off alone, because he would have had to subdue a family of 4, transport and bury the bodies, and drop the car off near the Mexico border, well, somehow returning back in time to be available to check on the family and stuff a few days after they got missing. Which also bears the question is, if he drove the car to the Mexican border and dropped it off, how did he get back?
Somebody would have had to see him or helped him and know about it, or, I mean, maybe they didn't and they just so... casually, oh yeah, I'll go pick you up in Mexico.
Exactly. Or someone picked him up from Mexico and just drove him. You know, a lot of hitchhikers get picked up and...
That's true. Which, just for like reference, Vectorville, where the bodies were found, is 2 hours and 100 miles away from where the family lived in Fallbrook, and 4 hours and 260 miles away from where the car was found in San Isidro.
So it's not technically impossible to do it in a day, but
it would have taken a while, because he would have had to drive from Fallbrook to Vectorville, which is 2 hours, and then to San Isidro, which is another 4 hours, and then 2 hours back to Fallbrook.
Not including however long it took him to bury the bodies.
Exactly. So, possible, but anyways. So, on to Merritt's trial. The trial started in January of 2019, so just a few years ago.
Wow.
I know, right? It takes forever.
Was he locked up at least, or just still being investigated, do we know?
I don't know on that one. I would assume he's locked up, but we don't know on that one. He pleaded not guilty and kept insisting that he did not do it. During the trial, the prosecution presented this alleged timeline of events. They presented that because of debt and desperation, Merritt gained access to the accounting system for EIP, the business, and stole thousands of dollars by writing checks to himself. When Joseph learned what Merritt was doing, he confronted him at the meeting on February 4th and threatened to call the police. Later that evening, Merritt went to the McStay home, where he killed all four family members. He kept the bodies there for 2 days, all the while issuing checks to himself on February 4th, 5th, and 8th for a total of $23,000. And then he took the bodies out to the desert, buried them, and then drove the SUV out to San Isidro. That was the prosecution's theory. The defense countered. During the trial, they strategized the theory that the police had conveniently settled on Chase Merritt when there was alleged evidence pointing to Dan Kavanaugh as the possible murderer. Dan Kavanaugh being the website manager for the business. Let's go over this theory a little bit. The judge denied the defense's request to third-party culpability, which I was trying to figure out what the heck this means because I'm not a lawyer. From what I understand, this meant that they couldn't present Kavanaugh as a possible alternate perpetrator, but they could ask the right questions about him to imply to the jury that, to like draw their own conclusions, that he could be a possible perpetrator. They asked the prosecution's witnesses questions about his relationships with Joseph and any tension between them after finding out that Joseph was withholding commissions and then how he took ownership of the company and sold it. So they were asking the prosecution's witnesses about this. The defense brought to the stand Sarah Kane, who worked as record keeper for PayPal, and Brian LaRocque, a computer system forensic analyst. Kane showed that 6 days after the family went missing, Joseph's PayPal account was hacked into and the password was changed. $7,900 were transferred from the account into Kavanaugh's account over the next 2 days. LaRocque then demonstrated that the IP address that the hack came from was from Kavanaugh's computer. They then brought to the stand forensic accountant Dennis Shogren, who demonstrated that in 10 months after they disappeared, he took over the company and diverted $206,000 to himself. Although the prosecution conceded that he did keep $126,000 to $127,000 from the company, they couldn't prove that the other roughly $80,000 came from profits from the company. So he did make out with at least $127,000 from the company.
And so he did do this before the bodies were even found and they were still missing.
Yes.
Both these guys are very suspicious.
Right? Like, up until this point, until I found this information, I was like, Chase did it. Chase freaking did it. And now I'm like, I don't know.
They're just both somehow opportunists because they're missing and they both decide to just hurt this person?
Possibly. It's possible. So, further into Kavanaugh. In January of 2014, the police obtained a search warrant for records from his account show purchases at multiple stores in Hawaii from January to mid-February of 2010 when the family went missing. And also show an airline ticket bought in his name from Hawaiian Airlines. However, there was no boarding passes produced relating to any flights from California to Hawaii or Hawaii to California. There was evidence to suggest that his credit card was with his then-girlfriend who was in Hawaii during that time. Investigators never cross-checked the dates with the person that he said he was staying with while he was in Hawaii. So they never double-checked that.
I have a question. So he just told his girlfriend, here, take my credit card, go to Hawaii for the week.
It's possible.
Okay.
I mean, she was in Hawaii during that time. It's
so it's very possible that those accounts could have been her using his car.
I mean, if I was in a relationship and then he's just like, go to Hawaii without me, I'd be like, I will just stay in the room and watch TV like I do here. Like, what's the point?
That's true. Also, according to activity on his computer, which was in the San Diego area, according to his IP address in January and February of 2010, showed that he was in California due to his computer activity.
Not in Hawaii, like he... I'm sure that them earlier how you said that he was in Hawaii was just him saying, oh, I was in Hawaii. And they checked his bank account and then...
Also, the case agent, during the trial, when he was questioned, confirmed that they had obtained his phone records, and that's how they confirmed that he was in Hawaii. The defense showed the transcript of the interview. When I say phone records, it's not phone pings or locations. It was that he made phone calls to businesses in Hawaii. Doesn't mean he was in Hawaii. Just means he called businesses.
I have a question. Did they interview the girlfriend?
It did not say.
Okay.
So, it just says that it was with his then girlfriend. I'm assuming that they did interview her because they knew she was in Hawaii.
Because she could probably eliminate whether he was there with her or not. Or,
yeah.
Or if somebody just happened to have access to a laptop for business.
So, in these transcripts, one of the things about Chase that was big in the prosecution's thing, too, was that he had referred to Joseph as in the past tense in various interviews. So Joseph was my best friend instead of is my best friend. And these were in the first interviews when they were missing.
What if he was saying, like, past tense because he knew Joseph was mad at him? So he's like, Joseph was my best friend, but I don't know about now.
Like, it's very possible, right? The transcripts from the interviews, which the defense showed, also showed that most of the questions that were being asked to Chase were in the past tense themselves. So it's very possible he could have answered because they were already phrasing it that way, so he just answered that way.
Yeah, like, what do you guys usually do on Friday nights, or hanging out, or...
Yeah.
If he got arrested, like, and he's already going to be put to death, well, I wonder why he doesn't just admit that he did it, because maybe there's that off chance that if they give him a plea deal, that he offers, like, the information that he did kill all of them, so they take the death penalty off the table.
That's true. But, I mean, usually plea deals happen, like, before the trial to give them a chance to not go to trial. So it's very possible that they offered him a plea deal and he just didn't take it. And then once the plea deal is off the table, it's off the table for good. Like, you can't go back on it. Once the jury has given their verdict, that's it.
I just have, like, total conundrumness on people that go to prison for these sort of things, but it's never, like, proved and they never admit to you. So it's, you never know. I'm just so, like...
This story is just crazy to me because... Okay, yeah, there's DNA evidence of Chase, and there's a lot pointing to him. But once I found that article with the transcripts and the, like, released warrants and stuff, it's like, there's a whole lot of stuff pointing to Kavanaugh, too.
There's a lot of what ifs.
Yeah, so it's like, what if they were partners in this? What if they both planned it? What if they both had something to do with it, but only Chase is getting... sentence
or,
for it.
Or what if they're both just crappy human beings that have nothing to do with the murder and it was someone else completely? It's just this one was a conundrum today. It was like extra.
Right? It still blows my mind. Like, there's so much questionable things about Kavanaugh for me that they just didn't go into. And that's what I was trying to find out about that third party culpability. Which, if you guys know about it, feel free to explain it to me, because I tried Googling and it does not put it into layman's terms at all. Like, I was trying to find it, like, the simplest way for me to understand it, and I could not. Like, the best way that I could understand it is that they couldn't present Kavanaugh as a possible murderer due to, like, tainting Chase's trial for some reasons. So, I don't know. I'm still trying to kind of understand it. But they, like, the defense couldn't fully present him as, hey, all of this is pointing to this guy, too. Like, take a look at him. Like, they couldn't do that.
I'm wondering, kind of going back to the Pam Hupp episode, how her lawyer was able to make sure that a lot of stuff on her side was not questioned or brought it into trial. I wonder if it has something along the same type of...
I'm thinking so, because I know they had Kavanaugh on the prosecution's witness list to be called to the stand, but he was never called to the stand. So I'm wondering, like, did they just put him on the list so that the defense couldn't bring him into the trial as a possible, like, suspect or something? I'm not too sure on how all of that works yet, but I'm working on it. But it was so confusing to me. It was so confusing.
Yeah, it's confusing, and then it's just, like, why... I wonder if they ever, like, why ever do it? Because you'll usually get caught, like... Yeah, it's the point. Doing it.
And, like, there was no... I couldn't find anything about them going back and testing the home because they said that the home had been sold. So I couldn't find that they went back and tested for any, like, trace of blood, which if they were killed inside the home and it was blunt force trauma, that's gonna leave a lot of blood splatter, which would explain the paint trays that he tried to paint over it. But they should still be able to see some kind of blood evidence, right?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the sledgehammer that they found. Was there anything on that? Besides, I mean, obviously, them being hit with it, but...
Not that I could find. They just... That it was suspected to be the murder weapon, and it was blood force trauma that killed them. But other than that, like, it didn't say anything.
Okay. I wonder if, like... The mom noticed anything while she was cleaning? Like, did she notice anything weird? Like, besides the mess they left? Like,
yeah. Like, imagine her cleaning and, like, leaning up against one of the walls if it was painted over and it's still being wet.
I know.
From if it was painted. Something was painted in that house.
Yeah. There was just so many, like which, conundrums. Like,
to the police, like, none of that raised any flags because... The house was still under renovation, and they said there wasn't a lot in the house, so there wasn't a lot for them to, like, get a personality from the family or anything like mm-hmm. that. So it's very possible that they saw a paint tray and were like, oh, they're painting. They were just painting the day before, you know? So, yeah. But yeah, it's...
It'd probably be hard because they were buying a bunch of new stuff on Craigslist. You don't know what yeah. stuff's going to be brought in. Too, yeah. Like...
So when I first went into this case, I thought it was going to be, like, a very... open and closed case, and now, like, the more that I dug into it, I'm like, I don't fully 100% believe that Chase did it, or at least didn't do it alone, but there's, like, still so many questions.
a lot of questions. Holy moly.
Yeah, if
you guys know anything about this case that I did not mention or that I possibly got wrong, feel free to let us know. We're still learning, and there's got a lot to cover, but anyways, pictures, because I didn't show you guys any of these people. So this was Joseph and Summer, and that is 4-year-old Gianni, 3-year-old Joseph Jr. Their missing persons flyer.
They'd be kind of, like, a little hard to miss, like, noticing all
yeah. of them. Oh, another question.
Yeah.
Who took the dogs?
It doesn't say. Like, the last mention of them was animal control called, but no one says anything about who took the dogs or if they did take the dogs or anything.
Because honestly, if that's
Digger, by the way. The little one is Digger. And then the big one, who looks kind of like Molly.
Oh my goodness.
Is Bear.
He's a chunk log.
He's a chunk log.
Like honestly, like, if you guys ever go to my house and it's, like, a mess and my dogs haven't been fed at all, there's something happened to me.
Well, like, also, how would you exactly know if a dog hasn't been fed in a while?
I don't know. Because I feed my dogs at in the morning and the afternoon. Like, they get a split meal. But how do you tell whether the dogs have been fed or not? Because, like, my dogs don't sit with a bowl of food out all day long because they are savages that like to gobble their food.
I don't know. I mean, it says that the neighborhood that they moved to was known as the Friendly Village. Like, that's what it was called, too, because it was, like, such a nice neighborhood. Okay. So I'm wondering if maybe, like, the animal control just kind of, like, routinely checked the area and was maybe familiar with it. I'm not sure. But, yeah, it would be weird. I mean, I would get, like, if the dogs were abandoned for, like, 11 days and were pretty skinny and had no food, no water.
Maybe it was the water giving it away, like,
maybe. Or maybe they just were acting wild. I know, like, if I don't feed my dog at her certain time or whatever, she used to jump my fence, like, and she'd cause a ruckus until I fed her at her certain time. So maybe they were causing.
Yeah. So. But then, again, I mean, animal control officers have, like, a special talent for this stuff. That's I don't know.
I guess. Yeah. If there's any animal control listeners out there, please let us know. Inform us.
How do you know?
We want to know these things. So, this is Vectorville, where the bodies were found. That's Fallbrook, where the family lived. And San Isidro, where the car was found.
Oh, dang.
That's far.
So, they, like, drove, like... They drove, like...
600 miles.
Yeah, like, and then 600 back. Like...
Yeah, it's crazy. When I was, like, looking at the map, because, like, in your head, it doesn't seem like that much, but then when I was looking at the map, I was like, holy crap, that is a pretty long drive.
Well, I'm sorry for blaming the brother, then. I just like to suspect people early on.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, like, in the CNN special report that I watched, he did mention that, like, the dad had asked him a few times to go check on the family when they first went missing, and he was like, I'm busy, like, I'll go check on them tomorrow and stuff. But I guess that's just kind of like the brother, like, why do I have to go check on him? Like,
I know, he's grown, he has his own family, like, he's fine.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we're going to have links to those CNN special reports, so if you guys want to go and watch them, it's, like, super interesting, especially after you know that Chase Merritt was the one arrested for it, because they interview him in that CNN special report before the bodies were ever found or anything. So it's kind of eerie, like, seeing it. And I don't know. It's just, it's crazy.
The way he acts and stuff is just not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they, like, go into, they do, like, this interview with that friend that said he was, like, cold when he was talking about the family. And how he had done, like, some gold mining with them and, like, out in the desert area. So he knew that area.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I would just suggest you guys watch it. Leave us any comments and tips if you know anything about the story. If we got anything wrong, feel free to let us know. But that was the conundrum for this week. And it's last call now, guys.
One of our listeners let me know that, what is our website? Because we always have it listed with the description of wherever it's posted. But just to let you know, it is a kind of hard one to say. It's theconundrumbarpod.wixsite.com/TCBP. And that is Tango, Charlie, Bravo,
Papa.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. Make sure to subscribe to everything. And also make sure your notifications are on. Because somebody was like, I didn't get you guys' notification for last week, and it was because the notification wasn't clicked, especially on YouTube. So
hit that bell, guys. Hit the bell.
That's it for today, guys. Remember to stay suspicious,
stay strong,
and stay savvy.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.